We wanna smash, crash, pass, smash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we look at an important issue of corporate media propaganda. Let's remember who writes those stories. It's not a mainstream media, it's the corporate media. And independent investigative journalist Shelley Stanley joins us to talk about the importance of language and how we refer to corporate media as they create the United States of distraction. For the second part of the program, we're joined by Nolan Higdon, who co-authored the book with me, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. Stay tuned to the Project Censored Show for an hour about corporate media propaganda and what we can do to counter it.
Created by the criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's Project Censored Show, the first part of our program, we are joined by independent journalist Shelley Stanley. Shelley Stanley writes for a number of publications. She is an independent investigative journalist of African, Japanese, and European descent. She helped found Tel Rumeida Project, an activist and advocacy organization in Hebron, Palestine, and is a founding member of Land Up, an organization dedicated to cleaning land of toxins by growing fiber hemp on it, working with scientists. Shelley Stanley does not watch TV, and the topic of our conversation today will probably make that even more abundantly clear. The cause for our conversation today, more specifically, other than looking at all the work that Shelley Stanley does with Counterpunch, Truth Out, many other publications, she wrote a piece in early August that really caught our eye at Project Censored, because this is something that we have harped upon for years. And this piece that she wrote was titled Corporate Media, Let's Remember Who Writes Those Stories. And at Project Censored, we've been eschewing the name mainstream media for quite a long time, so much so that in our Censored 2019 book, Fighting the Fake News Invasion, former Project Censored show host and director Peter Phillips wrote a chapter called How Mainstream Media Evolved into Corporate Media, a Project Censored History. And we are joined today by phone by Shelley Stanley. So Shelley Stanley, thanks so much for joining the Project Censored show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to have this conversation, the elephant in the room of American society.
So are we, and yeah. It is such the elephant in that room of big media. But before we dive into the piece that you wrote August 2nd for Counterpunch, it's online at counterpunch.org, and Shelley spells her name C-H-E-L-L-I, last name Stanley, S-T-A-N-L-E-Y. Before we jump into corporate media, let's remember who writes those stories. Give us a little bit of a background about some of your experiences. What has attenuated you to this key and crucial issue about the naming of these six corporations that propagandize and misinform the public on a ritual basis?
My first realization that there was something terribly wrong with our media system in the United States and how manipulative and dishonest that it is was after September 11th. I was quite shocked. I was in college and I was really shocked by the way that things developed. I didn't understand the idea that there could be these people, you know, an entire group of people in the Middle East that hated us because we were free. You know, as George Bush kept saying, they hated us for our freedom, if people remember that. It just didn't make sense to me. It was irrational. It put an entire group of people in a certain box. They would try to pretend they weren't talking about all Muslims or all Arabs, but then they would sometimes conflate it. And so I just felt very wary of that. I felt very wary of all the hatred in our society. And I decided to go to the Middle East and see for myself if what they were saying was true. So I went and studied in Cairo, and that just happened to be the spring of 2003, which is when the U.S. military invaded Iraq. And so I saw the Middle East before the U.S. had invaded Iraq, and I saw that the things they were saying about the people were a lie, that they were lying about people to make Americans hate them, even though there was no reason to hate them. So I found a very warm, generous culture, people who would go out of their way to help. If we asked for directions on the street, people would look at us and be like, oh, they can't read Arabic. And so they'd walk us 10 minutes out of their way in the morning to the building, point to it and say, here it is, you know, and then go on their way. And that happened over and over, that people would just go out of their way for us, these young American students. I found no hatred whatsoever towards me as a woman or towards me as an American, which was very much in contradiction to what the government was saying. Then the U.S. military invaded Iraq. And at that time, the city of Cairo, that's 20 million people, people were telling us after that everyone stayed up that night and watched on TV because it was a night invasion, the tanks rolling across the desert. And they wept because they knew that everything was going to change in the region, which it has. For me, it was a very difficult time, too, because I knew it was a lie. Everybody there knew it was a lie. They knew that what they were saying about Muslims was not true. They knew that the U.S. didn't have proof of weapons of mass destruction. So it was a time of tension and grieving and things like this. So one day I was at a sandwich shop that I would always go to, and the shop owner came out to talk to me because I was always there. And he said, where are you from? And I was kind of grieving at that time. So I said to him in my broken Arabic, you know, I'm from America, but I think Bush is crazy. I don't support this war, and I'm so sorry. And then I just started to cry. And he just stopped me, and he said to me in English, he said, the people are different than their government. You are not to blame for this war, and you're my sister. And so, you know, I was able to have this, like, very human moment, a moment with somebody, and so many experiences like that where people were just reaching each other across this divide that the government and that the media was trying to put between us, but that wasn't really there. So we were able to just affirm in each other, like, we don't want this war. We're with each other. We know what's going on. And that kind of thing just kept happening over and over there, this very human ability to just be with each other. And so I knew that the government was lying. The other thing about it is that the Egyptian military at that time was arresting people and beating people for protesting the U.S. invading Iraq, which is an interesting thing. Why would an Egyptian military arrest people for their rights to protest countries invading each other? But the thing is, the U.S. government funds the Egyptian military. Egypt's the second largest recipient of U.S. military aid in the world. So then you know why they're oppressing people. And that was not talked about in our media. To this day, there's now been a coup in Egypt. The first democratically elected president was taken out by a military coup. We fund that military. That military is now like arresting thousands of political protesters who are protesting for democracy have been killed by that military. Tens of thousands imprisoned, hundreds of thousands exiled, according to Egyptians. There's mass trials of like 700 people at a time for being part of sit-ins, and they're giving people death sentences for that. And that's our military. Our money is paying for their military to do that. It's a military that only operates internally. They operate internally, and we're funding them, giving them second most money to Israel to do this internal war against people who want a democratic society. And that's, I think, very interesting because the media here does not tell us that. And the reason they don't tell us, in my opinion, and people can certainly think about it for themselves, my analysis is that they don't tell us about it because they think that probably we wouldn't support it. So they don't want to tell us about it because then we might get in the way of their agenda.
Shelley, on that note, what we tend to hear from the media is that we are going to save the day and that the people on the ground in these countries that we end up occupying or invading, that they're relieved or happy that we're there to save them from their tyrannical dictators and that we're bringing democracy to the region. Now, this would, of course, be somewhat anecdotal, but did you see any kind of split? Were some people happy and hopeful that America was going to free them in some way, or was it mostly people dreading what was about to come?
I didn't see a split, you know, even in Palestine, like people like Americans, but not the government policy. People are very politically sophisticated in the Middle East that I came across. I would say much more so than in the United States, because they have a lot of different sources of information that they're getting. But I basically saw mourning.
At these parts of the world where you were visiting, sadly, these are not new developments. They're rehashed developments. I mean, the United States has been strutting around the Middle East along with Britain and others since World War I. And what's been happening in Palestine since post-World War II, particularly after 1967, we've heard a lot of the same kind of message from so many other journalists, independent journalists and activists that have been there, that they were welcomed and people, of course, were worried or concerned, saddened. But the way that they tended to treat the people who were from the United States right in front of them was like 180 degrees afield, right? Like you had suggested, they were able to delineate that you're not corporate America, you're not Lockheed Martin, you're not Wall Street. You're not the military-industrial complex, Shelley Stanley. And in fact, you're over there helping tell stories so that they can get into the press and into the news media, because the corporate media won't cover any of this. It's all top-down managed news propaganda. And of course, that's what's at the heart of the piece that you wrote, which again, I have to say, for all the books and pieces and analysis and so on that I've seen and even written about this topic, yours to me was so striking and just so much to the point and so simple that that's why we had to just repost it. And I'm going to use it in my classes this fall as a starting point for a much deeper conversation. But your candor and concision in this piece that you wrote is remarkable. And I think that when people go and see it, after they hear the story you just told, I think they're going to understand very clearly how you came to this kind of analysis and this kind of a position, because the corporate media, of course, is not telling people in this country about the things that you had seen when you were overseas.
Exactly. And everyone thinks for yourself about these things. But the thing is, we have to question why they're telling certain things and why they're withholding information from people. And the reason to me, again, for that is that they know we wouldn't support it. So they're basically lying to us and stealing our money to further their own agendas in other people's countries, using our money to kill people that we wouldn't support them killing. That happens certainly in Palestine. So you can just tell what is going on in the corporate media if you have any understanding of Palestine, because in Palestine, if you're in Palestine, they don't hide anything. The Israeli military, the police, they don't hide anything. It's all in the open. You can see it all in the streets. But the only way they hide it is through media. And so the media will just tell you a totally different story than what's going on, so that the American people will have no idea.
A lot of independent journalists that we know that have been there, our vice president of Media Freedom Foundation, Susan Rahman, just came back from Palestine. Abby Martin has been there. She just did a film, Gaza Fights for Freedom. Nora Barrows-Friedman for Electronic Intifada has been there umpteen times. And they all have a similar story. Manar Mahawish has connections there. They all have the same story of corporate media propaganda. The people who call themselves journalists that work for these corporate outlets don't even step foot in Palestine. They write about it from across the way. It's almost like they're fake news foreign correspondents in Germany in the late 19th century, where they would send people somewhere, but not where they said they were sending them. And they would just concoct stories to send home to buttress particular political viewpoints and agendas, or just outright infotainment or entertainment. I think that the corporate press is the same. And that's what they're doing here. And on the run-up to the Iraq War, as you recall very well, there was a relentless barrage of pro-war propaganda, so much so that Phil Donahue had one of the top-ranked shows on MSNBC and got sacked from his own program because he refused to have two or three pro-war guests on if he had even one anti-war guest on. It was a remarkable show of bias. I want to remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri. We're speaking with independent investigative journalist Shelley Stanley. She's been published in Truthout, Counterpunch, and other places. And, of course, she also wants to remind us that she does not watch television. And there are some pretty great reasons for that. We've covered some. We'll cover more after this musical break. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. We're speaking right now with investigative journalist Shelley Stanley. She does not watch TV, and Shelley Stanley, in your piece for Counterpunch, August 2nd, corporate media, let's remember who writes those stories, that pretty much is why you're not watching TV. And one of the things that we've talked about at Project Censored for years is to tell people that they actually have an option. Instead of changing the channel, they could turn it off. And they could seek out independent investigative voices like yours and many others that we highlighted at projectcensored.org. So let's get into this piece of yours. And then, of course, I'm happy to have you add on to some of the things that relate to this in each way. You start by saying corporate media. We really need to say those words much more. So who owns corporate media, Shelley?
Corporations.
There you go. And you have a nice call and response that you set up here in the article. You say, do corporations care more about the earth or corporations, Shelley?
Corporations.
There you go. Do corporations care more about racial unity and healing or corporations? Well,
corporations.
We see where this is going. And again, this is why this is a very powerful piece, is you ask very key questions about the things that matter to humanity and the things that matter every day in people's lives. But then you juxtapose it with, well, do corporations care more about that, or do they care more about their bottom line, and then therefore narratives that support that bottom line? And of course, you go through this whole litany of things, only of course to end up, right, by saying, does corporate media spend its vast energy talking about the sacredness of all life, ensuring this value is foremost in our minds? The answer is no. Who owns corporate media? Corporations. Who do corporations care about most? Themselves. Corporations. And Shelley Stanley, I'm curious as to the feedback that you may have received from this, because there are many, many people whom I would refer to as erudite, learned, independent journalists, people even on the progressive left end of the spectrum, that cannot seem to pry themselves from the corporate and propagandistic coup d'etat that is the term, the linguistic coup d'etat, that is the phrase mainstream media. There's nothing mainstream about six corporations that control most of what we hear, read, and see. Can you expand on that?
One thing that I will note that was very interesting as a response was that people that were pro-Trump actually really liked the piece and were talking about how if there was a candidate that would take on corporate media, they would vote for them. So I think that shows that it's a bipartisan issue for people when they do think about it, when they do realize. A lot of people don't trust corporations, and we have a lot of good reasons for that. So that's a bipartisan thing. I think the thing with American people being so caught up in this TV thing and this media thing is that it's an unconscious, it's not a thought out thing. It's like, for some reason, people think about the media as just being some benign, almost natural force that's just there to entertain us and be kind to us and make us happy. And so people don't think about who owns the media. It's six corporations. They have a lot of money that they're making. They have a very limited range of things they're showing. And people don't think about how limited it is. Let's just talk about things that aren't on TV to show how limited what is on TV is. One thing is, what if there was a channel that was completely Native American run? People could have like 1 hour people talking about the U.S.-Mexico border and how it doesn't exist for them. Or people could, it could be just like 1 hour regular people talking about what they want to see change about America, Native people. People could have poetry, they could have singing, all these beautiful things that would be Native run and just one channel that anyone can go and look at it. Like, why is that not on TV? What if TV was a democratic institution where we could have a channel where we would talk about education in the country and like students could be on there talking about what they need from education. Teachers could be on there talking about what they want change, and parents could be on there saying like, this is what our kids need that we see. And we talk to each other through the TV. Like, that's not what's done. It's programming that's given to us, like couched in a thing that's like benign and really nice and fun and stuff like this. But they're like completely taking away our ability to talk to each other, to think. They're telling us basically what reality is, but couching it in a really nice way that makes people not think about it. So that, I think, is just this major problem in our society, that people aren't thinking about what they're consuming. They're letting other people, the way the setup is now, is there's these pundits on TV that tell us what reality is. And they tell us that the only way we can change things is to vote. And if that doesn't work, write to your representative. And if that doesn't work, like, vote for someone else next time. And it's so disempowering. It's like they're taking away our intelligence, our creativity, our ability to solve our own problems and to think and to live. And they just want us to sit in our homes consuming what they're giving us and calling that entertainment when they're totally disempowering us and lying to us, as we talked about.
So, Shelley, I want to pull it back to the language choice for a second here, the idea of corporate media versus mainstream media. Obviously, there's benefits to labeling the media as corporate media because it inherently explains the for-profit motives behind the news and information you're gathering. So it's useful in that sense. But I also think there's perhaps an even stronger argument to move away from the term mainstream media in general, because mainstream is defined as the ideas, attitudes, or activities that are regarded as normal or conventional, the dominant trend in opinion, fashion, or the arts, etc. So if our media really was mainstream, you would see them fighting for or being proponents of issues where the public at large agrees. For example, people should have healthcare. There should be universal background checks. So a lot of these issues that are mainstream, you would assume that if they really are the mainstream media, that they would model or represent those viewpoints.
When you were saying that, I was wondering who came up with that word mainstream, because it's clever. It's like, yeah, this is just what everyone thinks, which is how things go sometimes. If they say it on the media so much, everyone does start saying it. But yeah, I definitely agree that the name should change. And also that we should really research who is behind these corporations, because it's really like a corporate media business alliance. Who are the people on the boards of these corporations? Who are the people on the boards of ABC?
Who's on the board, say, at Disney, that's also on the board at Lockheed? Right?
Kind of.
This is what critical thinking is about. This is what critical media literacy education is about and what we try to do. And again, deconstructing the language of mainstream media is, I think, one of the simplest and most effective exercises to unveil to people that they're being bamboozled. Who appointed the punditocracy as the expert class, for example? What makes them experts? The fact that they're on TV.
Yeah, that's a good... The pundits, that's one of my most degrading things for me mostly when I see these people up there that are touted as experts. Like someone who's never been to China, for example, that's got a PhD from Harvard and wrote a book on China or a bunch of books, and then they're like an expert on China. You just get to sit up there at Babylon, and every opinion that you say is supposed to be the truth for America to be guided by. And it's just absurd, really, the fact that people are listening to these people instead of thinking for themselves.
Yeah, it borders on criminal in terms of what the First Amendment is all about and the Telecom Act of 1934. And of course, Society of Professional Journalists, Code of Ethics. We've run far afield of that. But you're right, I've been pointing out, you know, the punditry, the pundit class is supposed to exhibit some kind of clinical detachment so that it, it appears to be objective, whatever that was supposed to mean. To suggest that, quote, mainstream media, i.e. corporate media and establishment state media, is somehow objective is just tacitly absurd straight on the face of it. So I think I think that this clinical detachment is supposed to project this idea of the objective expert so that it moves the audience into a direction, lulls them into this idea that, oh, well, the smart people are telling me what's going on and I don't know as much as them. And as you suggested, Shelley Stanley, they'll even get you doubting your own eyes and doubting your own world experience. Isn't that right?
For me, it's when you said that they're objective. I mean, having not watched it for so long, and then when I see glimpses of it, it's like, it's so clear that they're all on the same page. They're pushing certain agendas. I know for so many Americans, like you said, this questioning of oneself or this lack of self-confidence, lack of empowerment, really, that's really at the key of all of this. You can see that it's in a lot of ways coming from the fact that people are sitting in their homes, like watching TV with terrible energy. Like a lot of TV programs have terrible energy. It's people yelling at each other, violence. Terrible energy in your home on a daily basis makes you insecure. It makes you not trust your own neighbor, makes you feel disempowered, like you can't do anything to change the world, when all of that's untrue. If we just think for ourselves and actually live our lives, we'll be in a much better position to do things in the world and to change things than if we just sit back and consume energy that makes you think you're stupid, basically. Because that's how they treat each other on those pundit shows. It's like, all these people are stupid, you're stupid, I'm smart. The most terrible way to have a conversation.
They're modeling a horrific form of dysfunctional communication as if it's the norm for civic engagement. It's, I mean, it's just a train wreck. It's really dragged political discourse in this country down collectively. I'm not pretending that we have some high mythic history somewhere where we had all kinds of high-minded intellectual types. But it seems that in the past several decades, the neoliberal backslide from the Nixon years on through Reagan, now through the neoliberalization and rightward turn of the Democrats through Clinton to Obama, and now Trump, the mask is basically ripped off, and you know, it's almost like we're kind of like back, it's like a time machine, back to the 19th century in a lot of ways. And I think that the corporate media has played a significant role in getting us there. Shelley Stanley, could you tell our listeners where they can find more of your work? Of course, we were speaking about one of your pieces called Corporate Media. Let's remember who writes those stories at counterpunch.org. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners about how they can follow your stellar and important work?
Right now, I have a profile on muckrake.com that you could find me on, Shelley Stanley. This is interesting to me, and I hope to other people, but I wrote a bunch of pieces about the Jussie Smollett case. That's another one of these corporate media situations where a part of the story was told and a bunch of it was not told. And they literally just went after this guy and dragged the entire country to become like, kind of act like a lynch mob against him, a victim of a hate crime. One of those things that's alarming. It's important for us to think for ourselves and not just follow other people's agendas and energy. I think like America has a lot of potential to really transform things for ourselves as individuals, but we have to be able to be responsible and think for ourselves and do what we need to do, not just let other people manipulate our energy and our emotions and make us think we're powerless.
Shelley Stanley, that's a good note to end on. We really appreciate your work and your time. Again, we've been speaking with investigative journalist Shelley Stanley. That's C-H-E-L-L-I Stanley, S-T-A-N-L-E-Y. You can find her work at Muckrake and also at Counterpunch and Truthout. Shelley Stanley, we want to have you back on the program sometime in the near future to talk about some of these other issues that you write about and are passionate about. So thank you so much for sharing your time and your story with us today.
Thank you, Mickey and Chase. And your work at Project Censored, it's very needed. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, we appreciate it, and we'll certainly be in touch. Our listeners, we'd like to remind you that coming up next on the Project Censored show, we're going to be joined by Nolan Higdon, and Chase Palmieri and I, along with Nolan, are going to talk about our new book that is just out from City Lights Publishers. It's called United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. Please stay with us.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. In the last segment, we were speaking with investigative journalist Shelley Stanley, and we were talking about the moniker of corporate media, of course, with a message of just turn off the TV or turn off these kinds of distractions. And that segues pretty well into this segment today. We are going to be talking about a new book that's just out from City Lights that I had the honor and privilege of co-authoring with Nolan Higdon, who's, of course, no stranger to the Project Censored audience. The book is United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. But since you all and the Project Censored audience already know who I am, here is Chase Palmieri to remind you who Nolan Higdon is. Chase?
Dr. Nolan Higdon is a lecturer in history and media studies at Cal State East Bay and the University of San Francisco. He is co-host of the Along the Line podcast and is the author of numerous articles and book chapters and has been a longtime worker with Project Censored and obviously co-authored this book that we'll be diving into. He is also the former co-host of the Project Censored show, so you all might recognize his voice. Nolan, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
So, Nolan, why do we have to talk about the United States of Distraction in the Trump era?
We've been delving into this topic of media and education for quite some time, and as Trump rose to prominence in the primary campaigns, everybody acted like he was the end-all, be-all, and we kept telling people, well, actually, the symptom of these 40 years of emaciation of our education and media system. And so we kept having to sort of answer that question. We wanted to write a book that explained why Trump is the obvious outcome of our policies for the last four decades. And we thought it was important to write because right now there's so much focus on if we could just get rid of Trump, if we could just get rid of Trump. As we caution in the book, many of the problems that allowed Trump to rise will still be there, whether or not Trump is in office or even, you know, alive long after he's passed away. So it was worth reviewing what these vulnerabilities and problems are in our system. So hopefully we could build some effort at trying to address them.
We start here, and I think, again, this is one of the big questions. And again, Ralph Nader did a stellar foreword here where he talks about the rise and supremacy of corporations, corporate culture, corporate capture of regulatory agencies, the corporatization and privatization of education, and of course, the consolidation of media. It was an incredible fit because this was the backbone thesis of our whole study, right, of what we were looking at overall. And start out by saying, well, how did we get here? That historical backdrop. So, Nolan, could you give us a brief background of how did we get here to this privatized democracy and corporate enclosure of our commons?
The big shift really takes place in the 1970s. Prior to the 70s, we had gone through about 40 years of large faith in government and government institutions since the New Deal through the Great Society of the 60s. But in the 70s, you had a series of events that challenged people's faith in institutions. You had the lies about the Vietnam War. You had the oil crisis. You had the Iran hostage crisis, Watergate, church committee hearings that revealed we were overthrowing democratically elected leaders and spying on peace groups and things like this. And as a result, people started to turn against institutions, and that created the space needed for corporations and pro-business ideologies to demand that we get government out of the market, arguing that our liberty would be secure if we allow the market to be free. And we got rid of a lot of previous regulations we had on media, for example. We used to, again, limit how many outlets a corporation could own in a particular market. We got rid of that in 1996. We used to have a fairness doctrine that tried to make a more balanced approach to news and mandate it. We got rid of that in the late 70s and throughout the 1980s. With those regulations gone, you ended up with the 50 corporations that controlled 90% of media consolidating down to six. And the odd part of that was just as less media creators existed or less media owners controlled the market, we were becoming much more of a mediated society. So we're consuming more and more media from lesser sources. And that ended up getting a media system that largely was focused on profits. And it wanted to tell us what to buy, how to react, what to support. And their first interest is to their shareholders. It's not to democracy. And there's nothing mandating that these news corporations have to support democracy or the electorate. And so we've gotten at this phase where we have the most mediated society on earth, but the majority of content people are consuming is highly suspect, to say the least.
So, Nolan, the title of the book is United States of Distraction. If I had to put you in the hot seat, what would you say was the most distracting story of 2019 so far?
At some level, it's the same distracting story for the last 3 or 4 years, and I would argue it's Trump's Twitter feed. Every time Trump tweets in the morning, so-called journalists wake up and read it, and then they publish a story about it, and then the news media talks about what it means and its implications and whether or not he should apologize. And then he comes out and he says something else, either distracts their focus or gives them some other fodder to talk about all day. Meanwhile, you know, the real lives of people are being affected, whether it be from things like poverty or climate change. We've had the hottest month on record, foreign policy overseas, et cetera, the war on women and women's bodies. Those things aren't really being covered in depth, nor are different perspectives on those issues being given to the public. Instead, it's all about Trump all the time. And some scholars even argue that, and I would agree, that we're at a phase of almost Trump fatigue. We have too much Trump all the time. And our reaction has been to tune out and not pay attention anymore.
You know, one of the challenges here is that this is not a book about Trump. And yet, of course, it was impossible for us to not talk about Trump because of what he represents, because that he is the distraction. He is the one that is leading the corporate media around by the nose and sucking them into their own narratives and really helping them, giving them the rope to hang themselves, so to speak, so that they become more and more disreputable. And early on in the book, we outline, as a result of the privatized democracy and corporate enclosure of the commons, as a result of policies like James Buchanan, Milton Friedman, the Lewis Powell memo, Reaganomics, etc., we talked about four public vulnerabilities and that this was the manifestation of this neoliberal backslide. Could you talk a little bit about these four vulnerabilities that we outlined in United States of Distraction?
Yeah, when it came to our media and education system, we saw four vulnerabilities in particular that Trump was really able to exploit to get his electoral victory. The first one was a sensationalistic celebrity culture. And the news media follows around any sensationalistic episode. I think one of the most elucidated scenes of this was on one of the primary nights. Bernie Sanders won a few states and he was given a speech, but you wouldn't see it on television because all the television news networks were focused on an empty podium waiting for Trump to arrive. Because just the very idea of Trump's outlandish behavior was more attractive to them than actually covering what was going on that night. The second vulnerability we came up with, which I think is probably the most pernicious, is hyperpartisanship. And it's this idea that people now measure facts, information, and people on their political affiliation rather than the validity of what they're saying. This is really dangerous because when you end up with where your political affiliation supersedes your commitment to truth, then those in charge of your party can really direct your behavior and direct your attitudes. And Trump was great at that. Anything that was against him, it was always a Democratic ploy. Anything that proved him wrong was some like Democratic Party propaganda. And that has really existed largely in the culture since the 1980s. The third one is a fragmented media system. America, for the first time, has a fragmented and digitized media system. So not only can we choose what information we want to read and which information we want to ignore, studies show we prefer information that reinforces our views. And many of the social media and internet search networks, they know this as well. And the way to keep your eyeballs on the screen, they continuously give you information that reinforces your view rather than information you may need. For instance, if you believed the Pizzagate conspiracy, which said that Hillary Clinton was covering up a pedophile ring in Washington, D.C., Google and Facebook are more likely to give you articles that confirm that fake story than ones that prove it wrong.
This is, of course, where the term post-truth comes in, that we've written about both at Project Censored and certainly in this book. The Oxford Dictionary term of the year in 2016 says, relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. And that's basically what you just described as fueling the fragmented media landscape. Isn't that right, Nolan Higdon?
Absolutely, yeah. Post-truth isn't the idea that truth is gone or truth is debatable. It's the idea that people decide not to believe truth and not to accept truth. And partisanship and fragmented media really play into that. Studies do show, though, if people have critical thinking skills, like take a critical thinking course, they're more likely to rise above hyperpartisanship and post-truth culture. However, that gets to the fourth vulnerability, which is our broken education system. The United States is no question has continued to defund its education system for the last four decades. And then they've put in a series of reforms that were under the guise of reforming education, but really ended up making it worse. The most famous of which is No Child Left Behind, where students would take standardized tests, and the purpose of the tests was to test the teacher. Those tests tested how well the teacher could teach, not how well or informed or educated the student was. And the idea was if schools did poorly on the test, they lost funding and they would close and be taken over by a private company. Well, that happened. That was launched in 2001. So now we're almost 20 years into the standardized test movement. It's continued through Common Core, which was Obama's initiative. And we end up with a nation of bubble fillers, you know, people who know how to sort of choose the best answer, but not a lot of critical thinkers. I mean, if you're a critical thinker and you're approached with four choices, the first thing you think of are what choices aren't here that should be. So it doesn't really teach critical thinking in that. So we have, again, an education system that needs to be reformed for the 21st century. In addition, back to what we were talking about earlier, we're the most mediated society, but we have no component in our education system to teach people how to consume media responsibly. Other nations did this, you know, 30, 40 years ago in Europe, Asia, and Northern Africa. But in the United States, we still have the most mediated society, but no education system to help our people sift through this information. And just to be clear, it's people of all ages. And recent studies have come out and shown that folks over 55, I believe it was, are 7 times more likely to share fake news than younger folks online. So this is a problem across the spectrum.
Right. And back to the education issue, too. I know Diane Ravitch has certainly called this out, the failures of No Child Left Behind. And we're seeing the first generation of people coming into colleges from that program. And then we're having to deal with things like so-called guided pathways and these kind of things, because allegedly the students can't think for themselves. It seems like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a lot of ways. And let's not forget either that one of the things that Trump was crowing about was that they won with the poorly educated.
He loves the poorly educated, I believe he said.
As if that's something to be celebrating in the 21st century. It's pretty amazing. Later on here in the work, we do, I think, more on news than education, but it does come full circle. And before we're finished today, we're going to talk about what I think is probably one of the most important of the chapters of the book. It's the last chapter, and it's titled Make America Think Again. I don't want people to think that this is just a screed or a rant for a couple hundred pages that just leaves people scratching their head and angry about the way that things are happening and how we maybe got here. But we also want to focus on some of the solutions as well. And in Make America Think Again, we have a great epigraph from Henry Giroux, the critical pedagogy scholar, who says, "In the end, there is no democracy without informed citizens." And so when we come back after this musical break, we want to talk a little bit more in detail about what is the direction that we need to be taking. And in the first segment of the show with Shelley Stanley, we talked about a lot of problems with corporate media. Nolan Higdon and I talk a lot about the problems in this book, but we also do talk about solutions. So after this musical break, we're going to return and talk with Nolan Higdon, co-author of United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and what we can do about it. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. In this segment of the program, we are speaking with my co-author of a book that is just out from City Lights Publishers in San Francisco. It's called United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. We've spent a bulk of this program earlier talking about media manipulation and corporate media. And in the first 15 minutes with Nolan Higdon, we've continued to talk about how we've gotten into this situation. But I'd like to spend some time here on the rest of the program, the What We Can Do About It part. And Chase is here, and I know Chase can probably talk a little bit about Credder, which is one of the organizations that we wrote about in the last chapter, that's Make America Think Again. But Nolan Higdon, let's go to you, and let's look at the Make America Think Again. Talk about what can be done. And there are two things, again, educators like this. You call it the 5 C's, right? The letter C, critical media literacy, right? So you have the 5 C's of civics education, critical thinking, critical awareness of media, community engagement, and cultural competency. And then you also have something else that you wrote about called Blues News. That's B-L-E-W-S. That's another acronym. And so there's a lot of things that actually can be done and are being done already to address the challenges we face. So Nolan Higdon, talk to us a little bit about these.
These are some suggestions for how we can build some really impactful solutions to kind of this United States of distraction we find ourselves in. And they're based in actual research. We cite a lot of research in there about why we think these solutions will work. And they're really based on an idea of transformation rather than representation. So to give you an example, in schools right now, there's a big push to get college degree in as many people's hands as possible, which is, on the surface sounds great, but that's where it's the representation. The reality is that what they're trying to do is dumb down a lot of the information, get people through as fast as possible, get their money without giving them an education. Transformation would be actually getting these folks who want a degree in there, get them the education they're paying for, the education they deserve, hopefully for free, and then being able to get out and have a toolkit of information they can use. But right now, like I said, it's representation. Just how do we get a degree, you're in debt, but you don't have any sort of knowledge you can use in the world once you leave. So these solutions are about actual transformation, and that's what makes it a really exciting book. I think people are dying for solutions. People are very interested in transforming the way our democracy works. People are interested in transforming news media with the new digital technologies at our fingertips right now. It's an exciting time to think of how we might be able to transform education, transform media to better serve our democracy, and hopefully get us away from this United States of distraction.
So, Nolan, we talked earlier about how the media or many different corporate media channels were showing an empty podium of Trump as opposed to showing Bernie being congratulated or celebrating winning a couple states in the primaries. I think in some ways it could be argued, and I want to pose kind of a devil's advocate here, that because of click and attention-based revenue models of media today, that the media just gives us where our eyeballs are going, and that everybody was fascinated and had their eyes transfixed on Trump during that time, and so the media was just giving us what we want. What would you say to that?
Trump got 3 times the amount of coverage as Hillary Clinton and 23 times out of Bernie Sanders, which amounts to about $2 billion in free media attention. Roger Ailes, we know, was a big proponent of Trump and saw his network, Fox News, as being the last bastion of defense against this fear of Clintonism. And he gave a lot of attention to Trump for that reason. As far as where people's eyeballs go, though, that it depends on the limited choices. So we have a generational divide here. Like, older folks tended to watch 24-hour news and traditional news. The younger people tended to be on social media. So that illustrates to me that there were different people had different interests. Social media was interested in different things. So Trump wasn't captivating that audience. And then from my own anecdotal experience, when you generally tell students, and I think Mickey could echo this for sure, in the classroom about real news stories that are going on that mean something to them, they get really turned on and engaged and way more interested than they are in, say, Trump steaks or something like that. So I would think that you can have a marketing scheme that makes people feel like they should be interested. It appeals to the audience that are already watching television news. And there's a political component to why these networks do what they do. But as far as people's actual interests, if you show like poll after poll what people actually care about, generally, it's not even these politicians or these policies. And a lot of things, the things they care about is like spending time with their family, spending time with loved ones. Those are the things they're more interested in doing than being addicted to this 24-hour news.
It's also worthy and worthwhile to point out, as we do in the very beginning, in the prologue, with the Lao Tzu quote, if you do not change direction, you may end up where you're heading, which is pretty problematic if we pay attention to that direction. But we started out with that quote from Les Moonves, the CEO of CBS, before he was Me Too'd and shown the door. This idea that this is what the corporate media often say when they're parading in front of Congress because they're trying to have more deregulation or push the fake news problem off onto the ignorant public or in any other direction they can. We should remember this. Moonves, you know, while he was the executive chairman and CEO of CBS during a Morgan Stanley Technology, Media, and Telecom conference the summer of 2016 in San Francisco, Les Moonves said this, quote, "Sorry, it's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Keep going. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS." And so that's definitely a way of showing that they're chasing the ad dollars or chasing the revenues. Now, here's the irony is that about 75% of the American public claimed that they thought that the corporate news media covered Trump too much. And so we get some kind of contradictory material in the data there. Chase?
Yeah, I actually wanted to jump in on this point because we talk a lot about the 24-hour news cycle and there's always this negative connotation with that. But the fact of the matter is, if we were covering important issues for 24 hours a day, well, then that would be amazing. So do you dive into the 24-hour news cycle a lot in this book, Nolan?
We covered that a lot. One of the most interesting big studies that we talk about in the book was Yochai Bankler, who's a Harvard professor. Him and his colleagues did a study of the way the news influenced the election in 2016, and they were looking at social media and television and other things. And one of their most interesting findings was that they really felt that it was television news, not social media or internet news, that had the biggest influence on the outcome of the election. That may change in 2020. As we know, millennials are going to be the biggest voting block. They get their news a much different way. In fact, more so than social media, we're even seeing that they get their news from YouTube. But at least in 2016, it looks like the 24-hour news networks, not fake news online or these Russian trolls or things like that, had a much bigger influence on the outcome of the election.
Yeah, I think it's also important to note, I had mentioned earlier with the blues news, the broadening of news media framing, bolstering local and investigative journalism. That was another thing that's here that we're discussing. Have more educational news media. That's the BLE. And then W, whistleblowers. Really create a culture that is friendly toward whistleblowers and allows more whistleblowing. So as part of our solutions for media, and as Chase just said, what if we use the 24/7 technology and the media platforms to broaden news framing, to reinvigorate local and investigative journalism, to have more directly educational news media programming by qualified professionals, people that study critical pedagogy, and again, use media as a teacher instead of something that sells things to people for consumer society. And then, of course, instead of having the corporate media continue to do hatchet jobs on various whistleblowers, whether they be Chelsea Manning or Julian Assange or Reality Winner and Edward Snowden and so forth, we could have a news media that champions that. And in fact, we have a strange schizophrenic corporate media that actually at one point was denigrating people like Snowden, Assange, and Manning as traitors and so forth, while they were simultaneously using the data from the leaks to basically sell their own stories at newspapers that they were winning awards for. I mean, it's totally hypocritical. Nolan?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we always forget that some of these whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning and others actually came to the press first before they did their releases with WikiLeaks, but the press wouldn't publish the information. So they had to go to WikiLeaks because our First Amendment protected press wouldn't do its job with this information that was basically handed to them by a source. It is weird how these whistleblowers are treated. Julian Assange, if you'll recall, was somewhat of a hero to anti-war liberals for the leaks he was doing at WikiLeaks, shining light on Iraq and other things. But then they just turned about face with these rumors that he was somehow in bed with the Russians and helped get Trump elected. Now he's this evil persona who they're going after. It's interesting to watch these relationships change.
We actually have a whole section in here called The Russians Are Coming, or The Single Greatest Witch Hunt in Political History. It's both, I guess, and neither. And the challenge of writing a book like this, Nolan Higdon, reminds me of the news abuse and junk chapters of the annual censored books at Seven Stories Press. We're writing about things as they're happening. You know, and as Andy Lee Roth at Project Censored and I like to say, the world doesn't stop for us to take its temperature. So it would be like you'd wake up every day and you'd be like, our editor, Greg Ruggiero, be like, you have to add another part about this. The Russian saga is never ending. And I think that we concluded, yes, that's right, because it is one of the biggest distractions. And we saw that with the Mueller testimony. We're seeing that now. In fact, when we were writing about this, we wrote about a phenomenon that media theorist Richard Grusin calls pre-mediation. And the Mueller industrial complex collapses, as Egan Bogost wrote, basically saying that it just sets up this topic to continue to get media to spin its wheels and talk about something in a future tense that hasn't happened yet and may not happen, and puts them on an endlessly speculative cycle through the 2020 election. So they are not doing investigative reporting. They are not going and looking deeply at any of the connections or any more things that are happening with that story. It's going to be ratings. It's going to be sensationalism. It's going to be titillating, and it's going to appeal to people's hyper-partisanship. Nolan Higdon.
I would completely agree. And if you're someone who supports the Democrats or liberal agenda, I would bet everything I own that the Russians are not going to get enough people out to vote to win an election. You're going to have to do it with actual policy and transformative thinking.
And of course, at the end of the book, we write about the importance of grassroots activism, the importance of local journalism, the importance of investigative journalism. As we write, we're in an information war of sorts, right? But it's not new. It goes all the way back to the 1920s and Edward Bernays. It's just far more sophisticated online. And of course, we even give resources at the end of the book about people, organizations, books, etc., ways people can get involved, ways people can become more educated, that also include Spreader.com, which is Chase Palmieri's endeavor to try to create crowd-contested media to build trust in media sources online. So, dovetailing and coming full circle with where we were with Shelley Stanley, one of her lines in her bio is she does not watch TV. And I think that we should turn corporate media off, turn TV off, or at the very least, if we can't reclaim it and make it work for the public interest, we should definitely be championing more independent and alternative media sources. And Nolan Higdon, your co-author of this book, United States of Distraction. And of course, listeners can also follow your work at the Along the Line podcast. And could you share with listeners how they can follow you online?
On Twitter, I'm at Nolan_Higdon. You can get Along the Line podcast at youtube.com/alongtheline or projectcenter.org/ATL.
So Nolan Higdon, thanks so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show. This book, United States of Distraction, just out. Those people that are interested in seeing us talk about this book, September 11th will be at the Grand Lake Theater, keynoting the 9/11 Film Festival. On September 19th, we'll be at City Lights, at the historic City Lights. Lawrence Ferlinghetti Geddes will be there September 19th at 7 p.m. Lawrence Ferlinghetti once wrote, "Our government is a bird with two right wings. They're devoted to the perpetuation and spread of corporate capitalism." So it'll certainly be an honor to be there. October 14th, we're at Book Passage in Corte Madera in Marin County. October 22nd, KPFA fundraiser for KPFA, Free Speech Radio, City Lights, and Project Censored. That's at the Hillside Club in Berkeley. That's at 7:30 p.m. We'll have more information about that online. But Nolan Higdon, thanks for joining us on the program. Looking forward to our speaking tour this fall.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is executive producer and host of the program with myself, Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer and Dennis Murphy is our associate producer. The Project Censored Show airs on over 50 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archived programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to The Project Censored Show on YouTube and your cell phone's podcast app. Feel free to share your feedback about our work, and last but not least, thanks to all of you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Right with waves full of poison, genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens hypnotized by the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip the brothers in our